Elbphilharmonie Talk, der Gesprächspodcast der Elbphilharmonie.
Welcome to another episode of Elbphilharmonie Talk. This is Tom Schulz speaking. I am the principal host of this podcast series, which is being produced by Elbphilharmonie Hamburg, the place to be for all those who love the best music in the world. In this season, the Elbphilharmonie counts in seasons, just as theaters do and opera houses or soccer teams for that matter. We had something completely new for us. We had a so-called creator in residence. Now, I belong to a generation that associates the word creator primarily with someone all-encompassing, high above us and eons away, someone like God. And if it's not him or her in person I think of, then it's the great jazz saxophonist Farrar Sanders and his passionately trancy piece The Creator Has a Master Plan that comes to my mind. But in the era of social media, being a creator has become something quite mundane, as the noun refers simply to a person who is creating, not life and all the wonders on earth, but just content for exactly those social media. So we invited a young, clever, creative person from the US with Korean roots to be our first creator in residence. A woman whose video podcasts are seen and heard by anything between several hundred thousands and millions of people. Nare Sol is her artist's name. Nare is not just your ordinary YouTuber. She has a degree in music. She has studied piano and composition both at Juilliard School in New York City and later in Paris and France. And she actually does work also as a professional pianist and composer. In her videos, she breaks down music theory in a no-nonsense yet very entertaining way, more often than not deducting theoretical issues from actual pieces of music from different musical eras, from Bach to K-pop, from Mozart to Rebecca Saunders, from counterpoint to jazz improv. She does her job extremely well, which is why we figured it might be a neat idea to have her come to Hamburg on repeat last season. She followed that invitation to communicate her views on music from our place and to also understand and comment on some of the specifics in terms of content, acoustics and people involved in what Elbphilharmonie does and stands for. She did several videos for our own channel, which can be accessed via our website, but she did many more that can be watched on her own YouTube channel. For instance, for her piece about what makes John Williams' movie scores so hauntingly effective, she would also gather material from interviews she conducted with artists she met whilst on one of her longest days in Hamburg. A couple weeks ago, we met for a conversation for this podcast, because I wanted to know more about her background, her remarkable work ethics, her love for Europe, her relationship to all that is Korean, and how she experienced Hamburg and our concert hall, of course. We spoke about many things, which would even include a pie chart she almost feels compelled to draw nearly every day. On those diagrams, scribbled by hand, Nare Sol subdivides the 24 hours of her day painstakingly into segments that represent different activities. She's using a red pen for all work-related times of the day and guess which pen runs out of ink first. And if you want to know how and why this is linked to the extravagant and erratic French composer Erik Satie, stay with me, stay with us. In Nare Sol, I met a wonderfully thoughtful and spontaneous person, very open-minded, yet very much in self-control. I hope you enjoy our conversation as much as I did when we sat together and spoke. And here we go. So, Nare, wonderful. We finally meet for
yes.
a podcast interview. And I've dreamt of doing this for quite some time. And then you were very busy doing stuff here and it didn't come online. And now, in January, kind of midterm of your season here in Elbphilharmonie as creator in residence, we sit down and talk, which is great.
It's a pleasure to meet you. And I've been looking forward to this as well.
Likewise. Thing is, I was wondering, I mean, you are so used to be behind the camera to ask the questions to people. Is it very uncomfortable for you to give interviews like this one here?
Not so much, because I think any interview, whether I'm conducting it or I'm being interviewed, it's really just a conversation about similar interests, and similar topics. So I view it kind of similar.
Yeah. So you don't feel like, oh, now I'm being X-rayed or something.
Not so much, but maybe I should. I don't know.
I don't know. Let's see. So first, or the second thing I want to tell you is, it's just yesterday I saw your Jungkook video, and which I adore, of course. It's the youngest of the seven BTS singers from this huge, huge Korean boy group. And it's so special for me for a specific reason, which I'm going to explain to you, because I have several kids, among them two younger daughters. One is 12 and the other is about to turn 15. And their musical tastes are utterly diverse, or opposite, I would rather say. So the younger one is like totally into K-pop. And the older one is like totally not into K-pop, but she is into music theory. And she has had some piano lessons, and she knows, you know, the circle of fifths and stuff, and she really has some brain going around music.
Great.
And I figured that this video of yours was just the perfect match of both, which became true. So we were sitting, all the three of us, watching the video, which I had already seen, and they would just almost kind of reconcile. You know, the little one was happy about Jungkook being analyzed this way, and the other one was happy with the theory and the arpeggios and the explanations that you so swiftly give about what you do. And I was wondering, how did this come about for you in the first place to choose this? I mean, obviously you have this Korean descendants, but was that the reason, or what
well,
made you do this?
Well, first of all, I'm honored that you and your daughters watched this video. The idea came from a previous video I actually did 2 years ago or so, where I took the vocals of another pop artist, Billie Eilish, and I did something similar. I recomposed the accompaniment or the backing track. And I'm just curious what it sounds like. Honestly, there's no real thought into it. It's just reimagining. Okay, I hear this music. I hear it a lot on social media, in stores, and then it starts to just have a space in my brain, and I wonder, what if the vocals stay the same and we just change the accompaniment, what's in the back, with something that I'm familiar with? Mm-hmm. Is there a meeting point? And I don't even do this as an intention to try to recreate the song. It's just a question mark. I know that a lot of it's not going to work, but I'm always curious to see overlaps in music theory, rhythmic approaches, these little details. And that's how it started. And then if I have an idea, if I have the time and the space, I will make a video.
I like this word approach very much, because I see you approaching like pretty much every subject that you decide to tackle. And you offer various approaches, actually. It's always the plural in a way, as is in this song, the case with four different versions. So it's out of curiosity of yourself to do this. And it's nice that you have us as witnesses of your search.
Yes, and I'm also very influenced by suggestions and comments and people interacting with me via email and different messaging platforms, because I'm curious about what people are listening to. I actually did not know this song up until recently.
Okay.
And I've been asked to analyze K-pop. I have a little bit, but I've never done something like this. And so whenever I have these ideas, I'll jot them down. And that's how it goes.
So the question to the audience at the ending of the video, just what shall I do next, is to be taken seriously.
Yes, really, absolutely.
How many songs do you have now in your list that people just request you to analyze?
I already have about 36 or so songs. Okay. That people requested. And honestly, I don't know a lot of them. I only recognize a few names, and that's what makes it interesting, because I'm curious about other genres outside of what I'm already familiar with. And I just love music, so I'm curious.
You certainly know that we will present the first really Korean act in the framework of the music festival in May, ADG7. And I wonder, have you any knowledge about them.
Not
I mean,
yet.
It's Korean shamanic folklore, which sounds quite exciting. And I've seen their Tiny Desk concert in New York, where they really went and did it in the office, if I'm not mistaken.
Do you know what... Is that the only name that they go by? Maybe there's a Korean name that they go by.
That could be. I mean, it's called, it's spelled ADG, like the notes on the piano, and then the seven. It's almost like a chord symbol.
ADG seven. I most likely have heard them because I've heard several Korean groups.
So it's one rather tall main female singer. She has two side singers, background singers, and then they have some very roots instruments going with it, and but it still is, or it is somehow contemporary. It's definitely not K-pop, of course, and it is going wild in some places, and it has this shamanic inflection to it, which is exciting, I find.
Yes, there is a movement of musicians that are combining folk music in Korea with pop and electronics, and it's just very dynamic. And
yeah,
I will check them out as soon as it's over, actually.
It's very flamboyant. You know, they also dance. Of course, my little daughter said, well, this dance is awkward. Because, of course, I mean, the BTS guys do it differently. And she studies them a lot. Now she has started taking classes in Korean K-pop dance. So
that's amazing.
She's really taking it seriously. And how closely do you follow the cultural life in Korea?
I try to keep in touch with it more and more as I'm getting older. And so growing up, everything was very Koreanized in the home. But that's, of course, a small unit. And I wasn't really familiar of what's going on in Korea. Pop culture, even the language is different. And over the years, I have tried to get to know the music of Korea a little more. And of course, it's been easy for me because Korean culture, K-pop, Korean media, all of these things have been just, you know, exploding. And also it's a growing interest of mine in music. For example, recently I did a project where I'm combining contemporary piano and bass with influences of classical and jazz with Korean percussion, with the kugak.
Cool. So like, and that's a trio that also performs at times?
Yes. So we've done a few shows and it was really meant to be an experiment. Hopefully this continues, but it was such a dynamic marriage of, of very different worlds.
Have you been traveling on a more or less regular basis to Korea when you were growing up?
Or no, not
never,
so much.
You never went?
Not so much until recent times.
Yeah. And the same applies to Europe. I was wondering, I mean, you are a creator in residence at the Philharmonie. Have you been traveling in Europe much before? Or was that probably the first time for you to ever set foot on this continent?
For Europe, I have been traveling here much more than any other part of the world since I was in my early teens, mostly for piano, as a piano student, as a pianist. And there was also a year and a half or so after my bachelor studies where I studied in Paris.
Oh, right. You were studying composition and working.
And surrounding that time, I was traveling to many surrounding countries, Germany for sure. And I feel quite comfortable in Europe. Of course, I do feel very foreign still, but... I do love being in Europe.
I imagine it must be very fascinating because, you know, this is where the music that you love and work on since 25 years originates from, more or less. I mean, these European countries, and going there and trying to make sense of it all. And of course, this continent has dramatically changed over the past 200 years or so. And was this also like, when you came to Paris to study composition, was this like an awe moment to be here?
It was, because for the first time, I could feel and actually be in a space where my heroes were walking and making music in. And that really changed my, I guess, attitude towards learning the music of past composers. Before, it was more abstract. When you think of J.S. Bach, it's like, okay, he's not even a person. He's a something much more. And as a young student, as a teenager, I couldn't really wrap my head around the fact that, okay, this was once a person, mm-hmm. like all of us, making music at an organ, at a piano. And when I was able to visit different locations and also just be in the city, in the continent of these composers, I could see their music and hear and feel their music in a different way and relate to it differently. So that really stood out to me. My first few visits, and even now when I come to Europe, I just think, wow, this is where they were.
I found that particularly striking in this Weimar video that you made a couple of years ago, which apparently has been 2015 or so. It's not the most recent of your yes. of your videos, and maybe we can talk about that later. But it's so obvious. I mean, the passion of these people who tell you who Liszt was and what he did and how he received his students. And I can imagine. I mean, it's such a small city, you know, and then you have Goethe and Schiller and all the German classic is like so much rooted in this small town.
It's really wild. It was very overwhelming, almost unreal.
I can imagine in a way, yeah, because then it's also very small. It's both at the same time. It's overwhelming, but the sites are not that overwhelming. I mean, it's a garden house, more or less, where Liszt lived. And then you have the piano and these huge, strange curtains that are yes. in these rooms. And
the design of everything, the interior, it really helps you understand the times and how it was so different back then. And you really have to use your imagination when you get to know the music of these composers, because today life is very different, but we are still humans and we deal with the same emotions. We have similar experiences, but there are elements of style, also an atmospheric thing
Quantities.
Attached to the music. Exactly. That one may not be familiar with from the get-go.
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
the more you learn about those times and also history, and the more you listen, you just become familiar with that. And I thought seeing all of the street corners, the actual house that Liszt was in, and his manuscripts and the sculptures around.
The piano.
Of course, the piano. That gives you a very different idea of, okay,
yeah,
this was what he was getting at when he yeah. was writing this music.
Did you do the same in Hamburg? I mean, this is hardly, you can't really compare those two cities, of course, in size, and what's primarily on their agenda, you know, like Hamburg is like a port city, and of course it has some musical tradition, and we have Komponistenquartier, you know, where all the old manuscripts are, or the replica of old manuscripts, and Brahms and stuff. Did this speak to you, or do you feel this is like more like a museum and it doesn't have that much relevance in the city anymore?
So far, it's been contained in museums, for example, the Brahms Museum. And yet I feel like I'm just scratching the surface, probably, because also outside of classical music, Hamburg has a very rich history.
Totally.
And so I'm just getting to know that.
Yeah.
Do you have any suggestions?
What you could go to and see? And I mean, of course, I mean, Hamburg is, I bet you have been walking around a bit and just seen the city apart from Elbphilharmonie and all this, what's to be discovered here.
Yes.
Did you walk the ancient Elb Tunnel, for instance?
Is that en route to Elb Jazz?
Yeah.
Yes, I have.
Yeah,
I have.
With all the tiles inside.
Yes.
And yeah, so you went there. So you know this one, which is good. And of course, I mean, there's lots of beautiful areas to discover, you know, over time.
And right. And each time I come here, I actually stay in a different apartment.
Oh, good.
And I've gotten to know different neighborhoods that way. And it's amazing how diverse the city is.
Tell me a bit more about that, because that was also one of my curiosities. How do you manage your life when you come here? I mean, there are certain periods where you stay here for 10 days or 2 weeks. I don't know for how long. What was the longest stay that you had here within the residency?
I believe the last trip was almost 2 months or so.
Oh, wow.
So it was...
In a row, like...
Yes, it was cool. Quite long. Of course, I broke it up in terms of I had to leave for different engagements, but in general, I have a difficulty adjusting to new locations, even though I travel a lot,
mm-hmm.
because the nature of my work, although I can really do it anywhere, I can produce a video in a hotel room, maybe have a portable keyboard, but I see a lot of value in having stability. And so to answer your question, how does it work? I am right now going back and forth California and Hamburg and for a while also Korea. And my life has been chaotic, I guess.
So, I can imagine. I mean, yes. It's super
yes.
far distant travels that mm-hmm. you undertake. And then...
So whenever I can, if my schedule permits, I try to plant myself in California, which is my home base.
And it's still Santa Ana where you grew up? It's the same place? Or
right now, it's in the desert in SoCal.
So like no city around, no nothing? Or
no, I guess I spoke as if you were from that area.
Not Everyone too much. No, tell me more about the desert.
It's east of LA.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, inwards.
Yes. Yeah. So not as urban, not as crazy, but within driving distance to LA.
So you said always different apartments. So this is, of course, already stretching somehow the comfort zone of the person who tends to have stability. So you have to readjust all the time. Then you say at the same time you keep discovering new neighborhoods. So what's stronger then?
I think it really depends on the season. I try to approach it with a flexible attitude. So I'm aware that it's difficult to relocate, but if I try to focus on the positives of relocating, each time I can discover a new neighborhood and things like that, then it becomes much more manageable.
And in addition to this, you have this kind of self-discipline that's being displayed in the clock chart that you have. You know, this, how do you call it?
The pie charts.
The pie charts, exactly. Totten diagram, we would say, and where you subdivide the hours. And I was trying to stop. It didn't stop the video to check what you're actually doing during your 24 hours a day. But the sleep was rather little, the portion. I mean, of course, it was the biggest portion, but it wasn't a third or something. It was maybe a fifth or so. And I was wondering, are you really so sleepless? Or
yes. So I made a video recently showing how I schedule things, and I use pie charts, and I use it as a visual reference. And part of it is so that I actually do what I'm saying that I will do. But also just to observe how my day is going. And there are things that I don't plan. For example, you mentioned I don't sleep much. That is true. I'm working on it. But that's not because I'm militant about I need to get up at 6 a.m. I think with a lot of travel and things like that.
Time zones and stuff,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
In recent times, it's just been kind of difficult for me to stay asleep. So that is why. I actually saw some comments about, Nari, you don't sleep enough. This is horrible. I'm fully aware. And the discipline comes from just years of experimenting of what works and what doesn't. Because for me, if I'm not disciplined about my time and how I organize everything, then I could easily just spend a whole week obsessing over one thing or just daydreaming.
Oh, the slouchiness just takes over and you just don't do a thing.
I'm a huge daydreamer and I could keep myself busy just in my own thoughts. Yeah. So, or just on the couch. And so it's to be someone in the creative field, whatever you do, there's a danger because you are in charge of your own schedule and it's really about the end goal. So if you're a musician, can you eventually perform that concert or Can you write that piece of music? How you get there is kind of up to you.
Yeah.
And so this is a blessing and a curse. And I've learned that if you don't manage the days leading up to what you want to create, then it's a disaster.
Then you get in a mess. Yeah.
Yeah, personally.
On the other hand, I think I would be the kind of guy who would talk himself into daydreaming, just being part of the creative process, because you need these times, you know, to just let your mind wander, and then it catches something that's interesting and brings you into a new phase of creativity.
This is a great point, and I address a little bit about this in my video, but it is so true. In recent years, actually, I've learned to value that and guard that time open-ended. Those days, a lot of times I won't, you know, have a schedule or pie chart. But sometimes I will, and I will just dedicate
to
I won't even call it daydreaming. Mm-hmm. Whatever I want, mm-hmm. whatever leads me. And
so, how many of these 365 days a year do you pie chart? Actually,
I would say a good 3/4.
Wow, that's yes. a lot.
But it really it depends on the year. Last year was particularly difficult and chaotic in my family, and when my life doesn't permit me to have predictability and regularity, then I'm not a stickler to.
Okay.
I don't think any system should be like something militant.
So there's no neurosis going on to really follow this.
No, I'm very happy to not do this.
Okay.
I just enjoy doing it. It's
also
nice,
a fun way. And
yes,
you are coloring your day.
Exactly.
And trying to keep track, literally, of what and when. And do you sometimes do it like in hindsight? You know, at night you say, I can just, or do you do it in the morning and say, so this is how I'm going to plan my day?
So if I have a very tight schedule and I have very important deadlines and things like that, then I will set it the night before.
Okay.
And every day is unpredictable, so I will adjust as I go. Yeah, for the next day. And I will adjust it as I go throughout the day. And at the end of the day, I'll just spend, you know, 2 minutes coloring. It sounds, I and I've read in comments, it sounds like a lot of work. Like every day you draw one of these things. But for me, it's just something like brushing my teeth. I enjoy the utility of it. And where it really comes in handy is when I start feeling a little off or something is just, you know, overwhelming me, then I literally scan through these pages and see what color is overriding everything.
Huh.
So for me, anything that it has to do with more administrative and non-musical work, I color it red.
Okay.
And so in the past...
Red alert.
this is the truth, but I've had in the past a year where over and over again, the red pen marker would just run out. And so I would just constantly get more red pens, whereas everything else was just fresh. And
so that was a safe indicator.
Yes,
something's going wrong.
I was being kind of a workaholic.
Yeah.
But you know what really changed things around was a very funny experiment I did with Eric Satie's schedule.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a few years back. I decided just for fun and to shed light on what a quirky character Eric Satie was.
Yes.
And I was reading some his journal entries and his articles. And so I wanted to do a video that is a fun way to introduce the history of Eric Satie. And I thought, why don't I do his kooky daily routine, which is, I believe, a satire, but maybe not. I'm not sure. you know.
Tell me more about the routine.
Yes. So I don't remember it in detail, but it's something where everything on the agenda is some odd time. It's like 7:13.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I eat 1.5, pieces of white bread. And then 7:18, I do 2 minutes of thinking, things like that.
Wonderful. Yeah.
And
it's called kind of a pre-Dada version.
Yes,
of,
exactly. Yeah. Definitely leading into Dadaism. And I took that page and I followed it to the T.
Wow.
I did.
And for an entire day or for a couple of
days? I don't remember if it was 5 days. I wanted to follow it for a week, but it ended up being, I think, 5 days or so. And he also had in there certain details, such as I only eat white foods. So the color white, and that's a reference to, literature and black and white. Anyway, foods. So my family was involved in this too, because I was staying with my parents, and so I actually did this. It was not for the, there was no faking for the video. And when I did this, there were things in the schedule that was, I forget how it was worded, but it was basically time, empty space to get bored. Sati was a great believer in boredom. And at that time, I was kind of a workaholic. And so it felt weird for me to have this 45-minute block where...
Like an unwanted remedy, probably,
yes,
for what...
Yes, and I was just... It was, quote-unquote, work for me because I'm doing this for a video and it's part of a project, but I felt really awkward. Like, what is this? And there were also things in the schedule that was like outside activities and very beautifully and humorously written. I encourage anyone to actually check it out because it's just so funny. But after I did this week, I started to value empty space and being bored, not even sitting there and thinking, but just letting yourself be bored. And the way that I schedule and manage my week changed from that video.
I love this because you keep learning, really. And as I said before, we are witnesses of your learning processes in so many fields of life, and just not only music. And that's really very inspiring, I find.
Thank you.
You know, for children, for instance, there are many pedagogues who say boredom is essential for children. If you keep trying to have them not being bored, it's not good for them. They have to make that experience in order to know what to get away from and to stick with it for a while.
How are you with boredom? And I'm sure when you observe your kids and you observe other peers of yours, anybody around today, we're constantly inundated with our phones. And this is also a very saturated topic now. Everyone has been talking about the technology, social media, the way that we are glued to our phones, this has something, some negative side effects to our brain.
And all this is a cloth for boredom in a way.
You know,
because what's underneath probably would be naked boredom, and you can't stand it anymore. And it's a very good point. You know, sometimes I'm just wondering, because I also tend to go into activities, or I listen to some music, or I don't know, I enjoy also looking around in the room. You know, we have an apartment where there's some space for the eyes to wander and to rest, so it's not too crammed. But boredom is a very important topic, I find. So off boredom to another topic that interests me very much, and that has to do with your jazz studies, I would say. I'm really interested in getting to know whether this has been primarily a musical interest in just familiarizing yourself with an area of music that you didn't know anything about, I would presume. Or were you attracted somehow by the lifestyle of jazz, if this still exists, I don't know. But if I see the people you are talking to, I imagine they still have a way of hanging with another and talking and rehearsing and performing. And how does that feel? I mean, it's very alien to the lifestyle of a classically trained and classically performing musician.
It is. I remember two distinct experiences that made me really pay attention to jazz, and just something in me switched on, and it's like, what is this? The first one was when I was graduating high school. So I was, I think, around 17 years old. Mm-hmm. Up until that point, I was not familiar with much jazz. This was pre-YouTube, pre-Spotify, and I was primarily listening to classical music.
No parental record collection whatsoever?
No, not at all. And so I was at this awards concert, and I was representing the classical music department, and there was someone getting an award in the jazz department. And they had this very interesting idea to put us together. And they said, can you guys do a duet or something? You both play piano. It'd be really nice if you could do something. And my brain was just, I had a huge question mark. What do you mean? What are we going to play? Mm-hmm. Like, give me the sheet music.
Sure.
And the jazz pianist was like, sure, let's do it. Let's just do it now. I mean, no problem. And that's my first experience of, okay, what is this improvisation thing? It's very
Why
different.
Is this guy so easy with it and
exactly.
I'm not?
This jazz pianist is actually quite well known, Emmett Cohen.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. And we ended up improvising.
You too.
Yes. He would play a little bit of a jazz lick or something like that, and I would recall or try to muster up something similar in the classical repertoire, and I was kind of grabbing from what I've heard and what I've played. You know, a lot of these building blocks are the same, so he would do something with an arpeggio, and then I would play something from Liszt, and we ended up doing it fine. It was supposed to be something a bit strange for the occasion, and I think the crowd appreciated it. But anyway, that was a memorable experience because I walked away from it wanting to understand, why is our methods of making music so different? Mm-hmm. And how is he and the other jazz musicians that I was observing that during that event, how are jazz musicians able to play what they're playing? When it just seemed like magic to me. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You guys don't have music in front of you. And the other occasion was now almost 5 or 6 years later. It was towards the end of my bachelor studies where I was invited to a jam session by some friends. And there was a jazz trio just going on for about 2 to 3 hours, playing various songs. Nothing was prepared. Nothing was planned. It was a typical jam session. And I sat there in the corner being amazed. How are you just, someone is just saying, hey, let's do, you know, Misty. Yeah. And they just go. And also, they haven't really played together much. And so this was fascinating to me. On my way out of that jam session, I asked the bass player, how are you guys doing this? I don't understand. What is the secret? And he explained that there's a difference between classical musicians and jazz musicians. And it's all about how you learned your instrument. It's a difference in culture. It's a difference in how you listen, how you learn music, everything. And so he was very critical of classical musicians, mm-hmm. and said, it's so different than being fed notes that you should play, and you know, classical musicians that have been doing this for years and years, like yourself, you can never learn jazz.
Oh, how encouraging.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so that was a very different kind of spark in me. It set off a spark in me because I just went away thinking,
wait a minute.
Not necessarily, but I just thought, why though?
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean? I mean, I if I wanted to learn German, I could study and learn it.
Make an effort.
I will not be a native speaker, but what he's saying is, no, you cannot do it, period. And so then for many number of years, I started to, quote unquote, study jazz on my own. It was just a lot of listening, and I'm still in this process because I realize it doesn't take much to understand the music theory and the formality, mm-hmm. how jazz works, how solos work, what exactly are...
Which you all explain also beautifully, you know, yes. the chords and stuff. Mm-hmm. And
there's so many overlaps that yeah. it just takes some time to get used to it. But what has been difficult is the culture and the attitude shift of why...
Would you agree that the culture thing has basically to do with rhythm? That this is maybe in the core of... The different rhythm conception, if it's a conception at all, classical versus jazz. I mean, this drum-driven music and this, yeah, it's another kind of viscerality I find often in improvised music and in jazz music.
Yes, absolutely, because you don't find that sort of rhythm and those types of grooves and the swing in classical music.
Yeah, I mean, Ravel tried maybe or some, you know, but it's incremental in comparison to what other elements are predominant in there.
I think it has a lot to do with movement too.
Yeah.
And for what occasion was this music written for and also played for? And that's why it goes back to the culture aspect. And who am I to say? I don't know how history unfolds in that way. And also this topic can be very dicey because depending on the culture, everyone owns and takes, everyone claims the roots of jazz in a very different way. And now the definition of jazz is also kind of...
blurry,
yes,
least,
exactly.
To say the least, yeah.
Exactly. But what I was referring to in terms of the difference in attitude and the culture is really a comparison between, let me recreate this music in the way that the composer envisioned this. And let me dig into these emotions and the message, the communication that this music is offering. And you really have to investigate and get to know the music,
mm-hmm.
and your medium in terms of bringing that to life. Whereas with jazz and bebop, improvised music, it is really so much to do with interacting with the original music, whether it's a standard or a chord progression or a certain rhythm. And most importantly, if there are other musicians you're playing with, even when you're playing just yourself, you have the rhythm and then you have the melodic notes on top. And how are they interacting in the moment and mm-hmm. in a spontaneous way, like a conversation? So instead of learning monologues that are refined pieces of poetry, it's about a casual, much, I think, maybe casual isn't the right word, but it's a more casual conversation.
It's nice, yeah, but I know exactly what you mean. I think one of the basic differences is, of course, I mean, this is a language, a common language, maybe a shared language, which is being used to express yourself rather than express the refined composition of someone else Of course, there's also your individuality in this play. You know, when you interpret a Chopin, they play differently. All pianists play differently, but they all aim to be as close to Chopin probably as possible. Whilst as a saxophonist, you are just, of course, you go through all this Coltrane, Charlie Parker stuff, but then you try to find your own thing, you know, and this is the ultimate goal, to be unmistakably your own self playing this music. And
it's very personal in that way. You're absolutely right. I love that wording of it.
And it would be interesting to see how does that translate then into interpreting classical music. I mean, people like Keith Jarrett, I mean, he would do both things, you know. He would play all kinds of Bach, and I think really very beautifully play Bach. And then he has his other wonderfully intricate counterpoint improvising side. But that's rare. I mean, in most cases, it's not easy to really excel in both fields.
I think so too. I have kind of some sloppy thoughts around this, sloppy because these are things I think about every day, and every day I have a different, I lean towards a different conclusion. But I think to really excel in improvisation, you not only have to be a master of the possibilities of what your instrument can do and what you can play, because you improvise in a way that is not actually maximizing your potential, because it's almost impossible to really truly create something 100% from scratch in the moment. So it's you're still using bits of your repertoire, your personal repertoire, how you interact with these types of rhythms or harmonies.
How deeply did you go into, I just mentioned him, Keith Jarrett, and his solo concerts?
How deeply?
Did you?
Yes,
really?
I'm very familiar.
Yeah, so because he says, you know, the less I know before I go on stage, the better for everyone. And
yes,
that he would, I mean, right now he can't play anymore, just the left hand, but he would just rely on his hands to find the beginning. And then, of course, there will be some encores with standards and stuff, but much of it is really, it's recognizably him, but it's unparalleled in a way, I find. And you are right, he's maybe one of the very few persons who really can create from scratch something.
Yes, yes.
But in his case, I would really argue that he does. You know?
Of course. What I meant is that what he's able to improvise in the moment, if he sits down and composes, it's not a matter of what is more elaborate or not and more refined. His ability to create this music in a different context and understand it to play as a pianist is probably even much higher than what we hear, because what he's tapping into is almost subconscious. And I've heard him talk about this in interviews and such, where he kind of leaves it to intuition. Mm-hmm. And sometimes he doesn't even know. And also he leaves it to the physicality of the instrument as well, which I find very interesting and relatable.
Yeah.
But what happens when you sit with music and sound and you refine it over and over again like a sculpture with the presence of time on your side, like over and over again, that's a different kind of work, I guess, and a different kind of process for music compared to something that is a direct link from your subconscious to what you're playing in the moment. There's just simply not enough time. For example, when we hear Keith Jarrett playing all of these beautifully, masterfully crafted pieces with great form, so much intricacy in the layers, like fugues and things like this, he is tapping into a different thing than to sit and write it down. And I think if he were to do that, he would do it in a different way.
I think so too. And then, I mean, speaking of pianist Joseph Inul from Weather Report.
Yes.
He would always say, you know, our compositions stem from improvisation. And he would record everything that they would play, and then he would start to edit and find the best parts of the improvised sections and make some compositional work with that. But that's a different approach.
But the editing and the... So in that sense, the materials that you're using with are much more on the macro end than micro notes, just plotting down note by note. Now you're plotting section by section based on improvisation.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the best approaches. It's something that I use personally for a lot of my compositions.
So you're also playing around and trying to find something that's... So it's not so much the abstraction in your head that flows into your music, but it's more the playing and then finding what speaks to you?
A lot of the improvisation that I love to do and I do often is kind of riffing on the possibilities of an idea that I have. And also letting my mind wander and my ears wander. And I'll capture it in a recording and I'll go back and I will extract certain moments that I don't really know why I played that, but it's something about it I want to keep. And then I will then take that and almost treat it like a seed. So then I start to water it and grow it in a different way. And that process takes a lot more slow time.
Mm-hmm. But that's a bit what I was speaking about with Joe Zawinul. I mean, recording stuff that you're just inventing in the moment and then really trying to make what's the worthier parts of it to, as you put it beautifully, with the seed to let it grow. So it's a rather jazzy approach, I would say, to your...
Yeah, somewhat.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Let's talk a bit about the records that you made and the partnerships that you have. I haven't heard too much, but some I have. And it's duos with the cello player, the most recent piece, the Mountain Goat song. Is this like a collaborative effort that resulted in this, or did you write for her?
So Mountain Goats was a project with Narumi Higuchi, a violinist in Manitoba, Canada. And I was doing several projects with them during that time period. And I was asked to write a piece for piano and violin that could be recorded remotely. This was during the pandemic.
Okay.
And so we actually put this music together without meeting each other. Mm-hmm. But the way I got to know her was that she showed me footage of her running in the mountains. She's an avid mountain runner. And she has this very beautiful cinematic footage of the British Columbian mountains. And I used that almost like images for like a film scoring approach. And I wrote this piece, and it's for prepared piano and violin. And as I mentioned before, the way I came up with the music is very much from improvisation. And I was improvising while I had the footage running on a laptop. Oh, yeah. And I was watching it improvised and then sat down and refined details and imagined what I would play if I was a violinist, that sort of thing.
Uh-huh. So the visual is really an active inspiration for you, maybe not only for that piece, but also for other music that you're creating?
Yes, I would say so. Mm-hmm. I've always been very fascinated by the relationship between image, color, and music. So I'm also very naturally drawn to film scores.
Mm-hmm.
And I've dabbled a bit in film scoring, film composition. But yeah, anything that combines images and music is always great for me.
Hence your long homage to John Williams and his specific genius in finding the right music for the right moment in the movies.
Yes, that was fun to analyze.
Yeah, I totally believe this. So just briefly talking about the YouTube work, it's obvious that you really put a lot of detail and In German, we would say kleinteilig. It doesn't feel like it, but there's so many little intricate elements that you add to the visual presentation of your videos. And this obviously is something that has really developed over the last years. I was speaking about the Weimar video, and the Weimar video seems so much more loose in comparison to what you're doing now. And I'm just wondering, are you A, aware of this, and B, is this just a process of you yourself probably getting bored with what you have done before and you want to do it different? Or are they counselors who tell you, I have an idea how you could change to do this way?
It's a very personal thing, and I approach every video differently. Of course, I have some default styles, things that I do as a video editor, but I think every video topic could have a different style. And I just think about this when I get started making a video. So what is the mood of this topic? And also, what am I trying to say? Because I'm a firm believer in, if you don't have something to say, don't make a video. And I remind myself this a lot, because a lot of times as a video creator, as someone that makes videos on YouTube, social media, you are pressured to have a consistent output. So whenever I have these ideas, I will almost have an idea of how much intricate editing I will do. Sometimes I don't find that it is appropriate because it distracts away from the rawness of the topic. But a lot of topics I cover are very technical. And the advantage of video is that you can provide additional information on the screen. And I'm also aware of viewers' habits that if it's too fast, you can pause the video and take a look at the music score, the annotations. And I just enjoy having that detail. But it ebbs and flows. Sometimes I don't think it's helpful and distracting.
At any rate, it's really finely crafted, and I really enjoy, the more I see it, the more I can really also pull my hat and say, oh, this is really a lot of nice work in these little details, in addition to the quality of the content, of course, which is more important, of course. Do you have something like a goal? I want to have like 1 million subscribers until the end of 25?
No, I don't have a goal in terms of...
It's about 600,000 now.
Yes. I think in the very beginning, because this is a common thing in YouTube culture, I definitely had periods where I just thought, this should be my goal, right? So should we go for it? That sort of thing. What I realized over the years is that I want to make videos in a way where I'm happy to continue doing this for the longest time. So that to me kind of makes having an end goal kind of obsolete.
So, because the longevity is more important than the peak.
So my goal is to find a system and also a process where I'm able to make the videos that are the most interesting to me and also made in a sustainable way. This is something I'm trying to figure out, because I can't pour 1,000% on making just one video and spend 6 months, you know, on
depleted.
It. Depleted. Yes, exactly. Yeah. So how can I find a meaningful message or something to share, put it in the form of a video that takes a lot of time, effort, organization, and continue doing this? Maybe it's not videos in the future, but how can I continue sharing this without losing the actual passion? Because I'm very aware that it's so easy to have that corrupted. And if this becomes a chore and a job in a way where I feel pressured to, you know, reach a certain milestone or produce a certain number of videos in a certain way and appeal to a certain crowd, then I think the point of doing it for me is something very different than why I'm doing it now. So I'm doing my best to preserve that and guard it.
Would you say this is just an artist's approach to the thing?
What do you mean if, as an artist's approach?
Avoiding getting bored with yourself, avoiding the preconceived thing, avoiding to do what you're expected to do, freedom of choice, unpredictability?
I think partially, definitely, but not completely, because when I talk about I'd love to do things that I just feel like doing, I think the most creativity comes from some sort of structure and some sort of limitations. And this is
that's not unartistic, I would say.
Yeah. It's so well known. But it's the case with video production and making these, I don't know, sometimes they're mini documentaries, sometimes they're just very passing thoughts contained in a video. I would just love to have, it is a luxury to choose the topics that I'm genuinely interested in and curious about, instead of 100% serving what I think will do well, what I think the audience wants. And I say it's not a complete thing because there's a bit of a balance. I respect my audience. I respect the people that take the time to watch the videos. And so I will listen as well and interact with them and keep them in mind. Because if you're watching my videos, chances are we're interested in the same thing and similar things. And if you know, someone is following my work, but they're not interested in Jungkook, for example, they don't have to watch the video.
Sure.
But also, I could be a friendly gateway of maybe you do, or maybe now by watching this video, you understand why your daughter likes this.
And it happens, serendipity. Like, people say, you know, I never watch ever K-pop, but that was so interesting.
And, exactly. Yeah. And so I just want to have a relaxed, authentic approach to that. And it's easier said than done.
Yeah, I know. But the authenticity is felt. And I think this is also one of the reasons why people really love to watch your work. Just to wrap this up, yes. I have a little either or list for
okay.
you.
Great.
And it begins with some culinary question. Would it be kimchi or sushi?
Sushi.
Bartok or Stravinsky?
Stravinsky.
Malibu or Aspen?
Aspen.
Convertible or Harley-Davidson?
Convertible.
Whole Foods or Alnatura?
Alnatura.
Yoga or Pilates?
Yoga.
Soprano or tenor saxophone?
Tenor saxophone.
Subway or bus?
Definitely subway.
Taekwondo or karate?
Taekwondo.
Walking or bicycle?
Walking.
Upright or electric bass?
Upright bass.
Soprano or tenor voice, human voice?
Tenor voice.
FC St. Pauli or HSV?
I don't know.
Two soccer teams in Hamburg.
Oh. Both.
Both. Elbphilharmonie or Disney Hall?
Of course, Elbphilharmonie. Wink.
Thank you.
Thank you. It was such a pleasure to...
Thank you so much, Nari. It was really wonderfully enlightening to talk to you.
Elbphilharmonie Talk, der Gesprächspodcast der Elbphilharmonie.